Congress with white girls brought me great joy. One day, Mandy mentioned that she was part of a cool club called the Brownies, so I came home and told my mama I wanted to be one. After having worked all day, she honored the whim of her 7-year-old, hustled back out the door, packed me into the backseat of her Chevy Chevette, and drove me over to the school cafeteria for the Brownie meeting. The school was completely dark because her 7-year-old had the wrong location. We drove back home, dug the flyer out of the trash can, found the proper location, and then drove across town to get me all signed up for Girl Scouts. As a hardworking single mom, my mother's commitment to getting me to that meeting taught me that she was invested in my doing positive activities that would enable me to become a self-possessed and confident black girl. She was also probably just a bit worried about whether I would make real friends, given this new social world and the higher track classes. Girl Scouts became my proper introduction to the social lives of Southern white girls, the deliciousness of s'mores, and the wonders of going to sleepaway camp. These new friendships also alienated me from any black friends I might have had. I quickly became the object of ridicule among my black classmates who accused me of acting white. I was not yet fully clear on what all the shifts in my friend demographic meant, but Tammy made it plain. There was a word, an angry, hateful, stigmatizing word that named the difference between me and my new white friends. I tried to make sense of this whole new world through the very vehicle that had brought me into contact with so much whiteness in the first place, a love of books. By the end of third grade, I had plowed through Judy Blume's Fudge series, all of the Ramona Quimby books, and every hardcover chapter book that arrived at my house from the Weekly Reader Children's Book Club. I escaped happily into fictional worlds populated by nice, adventurous, friendly white girls. I don't know that I chose these books because the girls were white. There were so few books about black girls to choose from. The few books about black people that I had, my Aunt Colleen had boxed up and shipped to me from the black-owned bookstore in Dallas, Texas, where she lived. A country girl in a small town, I associated access to books about my own experience with life in the big city. In the books to which I had regular access, the worlds of white girls were middle class, nuclear, and uncomplicated, which is, fairly or unfairly, how I imagined their lives. That spring, when the circular arrived for the book fair, I noticed one of the Babysitter's Club titles listed on the flyer and felt immediately drawn to it. I marked it down and asked my mom for money to buy it, along with some sticker books and other goodies at the fair. She obliged. When it came to books, my mother always obliged. When I made it to the book fair, I beelined for book number 8, Boy Crazy Stacy, the first book I read in the series. Book number 8 began a 5-year love affair with the 5 13-year-old Connecticut girls that comprised the BSC. Like thousands of other girls, I became a card-carrying member of the Scholastic Inc. Babysitters Club and received a real-life printed membership card and welcome packet in the mail with a letter penned by Anna M. Martin, the series author. In the 5th grade, I tried to start my own Babysitters Club before I realized that I really didn't have any babies to sit, and before I realized, quite frankly, that my single working mama would not take too kindly to this venture of mine, since it would probably amount to extra work for her. Regretfully, I reached into the makeshift loose-leaf paper envelope I had stapled together and refunded each girl her 50 cents in club dues. Each month when my allowance arrived, just in time for my mother's and my monthly sojourn to the closest mall 30 miles away, I would set aside my $4 and change to purchase the newest book in the series. I loved that it was a series because I didn't have to let go of the characters at the end of each book. As an only child, I considered the core members of the BSC, Christy, Marianne, Claudia, Stacy, and Dawn, my friends in my head. Eventually, they took on 2 junior members, 11-year-olds Mallory and Jesse. Interestingly, Jesse was African-American, but I was never too pressed to read about her. I already knew what it felt like to be the only one in a friend group of white girls, and Ann Martin never quite captured that experience. But what I loved about these girls was the authenticity of their friendship. They were young, smart, and enterprising. They didn't all think alike, but they did things together. They weren't the mean girls or the cool kids, but they had their sacred friendship unit, and they honored it. In the safety of that friendship unit, every girl was her full, best, awesome self. They fought sometimes, but always made up. And in the end, no matter what, they rode for each other. I longed for that kind of close female comradeship. I craved it. As thankful as I was for sleepovers and friends to play with at school, none of my friendships ever felt like the Babysitter's Club. White girls for me existed in real life somewhere on a continuum from Mandy, the best of them, to Tammy, the worst of them. When in 2010, my homegirl and I created a blogging crew called the Crunk Feminist Collective, it occurred to me after we were up and running and functioning well that my first act in adulthood after getting my first real job was to basically create a black girl adult version of the Babysitter's Club. The project we undertook together wasn't babysitting, but the essential concept was the same. A group of young women who came together around a shared thing that we all did to change our little corner of the world for the better. Black feminism taught me my feminism, and hip-hop taught me my crunk, but the Babysitters were the first to help me imagine what the contours of loving female friendships could look like. These days, any show, past or present, that demonstrates authentic loving friendships between strong women, including mothers and daughters, is always at the top of my list. Gilmore Girls, Grace and Frankie, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Sex and the City, Living Single. I realize now that I was mostly interested in understanding the very different lives of these older, northern, sophisticated white girls who, because they were fictional, were different enough from the southern white girls I knew and safe enough for me to admire and love without hurt or shame. At least, that's the explanation that makes sense to 30-something-year-old me. What I remember is loving these fictional white girl characters, even as I learned the perils and possibilities of what it meant to live closely with white girls in real life. My Babysitter's Club years were populated with racial slights from the white girls I called friends. Never overt, these incidents communicated that I was mostly liked, often tolerated, but invariably different. In the fourth grade, I sat at my desk one morning as my friend Candy, a member of the core group of girls I played with at recess, came around handing out invitations to her birthday party. When she came to my desk, she said, "I'm sorry I can't invite you to my party, Brittany, but my daddy doesn't like black people." I remember how her light brown hair swung from side to side as she said it. Later that year, when I starred in and co-produced our Black History Month play, The Rosa Parks Story, an idea I got from one of those Black History books Aunt Colleen had sent, Candy raised her hand first when the teacher asked for volunteers to play Martin Luther King. Her mother brought her to school with a bottle of brown makeup, which Candy smeared all over her own face. She then gave an enthusiastic rendition of King's I Have a Dream speech. Her mom was in the audience. Her dad was not. In fifth grade, I watched my friends and their families tie yellow ribbons on trees around town to commemorate Operation Desert Storm, the first Gulf War. A few months later, when we were all treated to the video of Rodney King being brutally beaten by four LAPD officers, no one at school mentioned it. I was left to discuss it in the blackness of my own home. In one of our deep playground conversations, which at tween ages revolved around everything from how it was to get your period to debating whether white and black people could date, Mandy told me that her daddy said, "Everybody should stick with their own kind." Still, she was my friend, particularly in the sixth grade when she saved me and Jim. We were sitting there talking about Judy Blume books, and I had just finished reading Dini, a book that I had gotten for a few cents on an afternoon excursion to Fran's Book Nook with my Aunt Punkin, who went there regularly to restock her endless supply of romance novels. Sometimes, on her way, she would swoop by after school in her old brown 1977 Toyota Celica, pick me up, and let me ride with her. At Christmas time, when Aunt Colleen came home from the city, she and Aunt Punkin would trade romance novels. I had also devoured and loved Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, probably because as a black girl raised in the Baptist church, I spent a lot of time thinking about God, whether he was really as scary as the preacher said he was every Sunday, wondering whether the world really would end before I got up enough courage to get saved, and wondering just who God was and how God thought. Mandy was having no parts of Dini. "Ew," she said when I mentioned it, "that book talks about touching yourself and stuff." "Yes, it's called masturbation," I said loudly to her and our friends on the top row of the bleachers. Mandy's face turned red and she ducked, telling me to keep it down. I had no idea that I had committed a cardinal teenage sin, that it was a thing to be embarrassed about, not to be discussed in mixed company. That is probably because even though I read the descriptions, I still wouldn't figure out masturbation properly until I was in college. And I didn't live in a house with older siblings who might have discussed these things. Mandy looked out for a sister that day, because getting caught talking about masturbation is only second in disaster potential to getting caught doing it. On her birthday that year, we had a sleepover at her house and went to the dollar movies to see Fried Green Tomatoes. Late that evening, upon our return, all the girls were styling each other's hair, but no one was allowed to touch mine. A cardinal rule of black girls is that when your mama has sat up all night styling your hair, you don't let anybody else touch it. So I played in theirs, learning about the difference in textures and that you didn't need to pull a comb through a white girl's hair with nearly as much force as it took to pull a comb through a black girl's kinks and curls. White girls were exceedingly tender-headed, and it took me a few tries before Mandy stopped saying, "Ouch, not so hard." That ability to have a world that is centered on the prerogatives of white femininity, to command someone to stop pulling and tugging so hard upon request, is so far from the truth of so many black girls' lives. A delicate fine-tooth comb is no match for the average black girl's hair. We require wide-tooth combs that are sturdy and strong and can hold our thick tresses firmly and gently at the same time, without breaking them or hurting us. For many of us are tender-headed too. By the way, we require the same things from our lovers, our mothers, and the country in which we reside. This is not a one-comb-fits-all nation. Before the natural hair revolution emerged in the early 2000s and chided us for relaxing and combing the hell out of our springy, gravity-defying black girl hair, most of us sat between our mama's knees and took it. We endured the endless hours of washing, detangling, drying, oiling, parting, twisting, and plaiting our hair into respectable styles so that we could look like we belonged to somebody. And it was precisely because this process took hours that we were not ever allowed to let anybody touch our hair. But the process of our mothers and aunties and big sisters and grandmothers lovingly tugging our hair into place is often the first lesson black girls learn about the inherently tough conditions we face, about how much effort it will take to prepare us to face a waiting world, about where our safe havens are and always will be, in community with women. Who you let put their fingers in your head is sacred. The politics of black women's hair matters. It matters in a world where, as I learned at Mandy's party, the comb never slips through our hair quite so easily as it slips through theirs. Later that spring, when my classmate Layla had her pool party, the great hair divide was on full display. We were in the pool in her backyard playing Marco Polo and water tag and all manner of other games. I was under express orders not to get my hair wet because chlorine and permed hair don't mix. As I clung to the edges of the pool, both because I couldn't swim and because I was trying to limit the amount of water that seeped inside my swim cap, my friends' mothers whispered to each other by the side of the pool. "I don't understand why it's that serious. It's just hair. Kids should just get to be kids." Of course, my mama wasn't there to defend herself because she had to work. Still, my efforts proved futile and my hair got wet anyway. When mama walked in under the judging eyes of the white moms hanging by the pool, I said, "I'm sorry for getting my hair wet, Mama. I tried not to." To which she replied, "We'll just have to wash it." She didn't make a big deal about it, and I was grateful. But washing and styling my hair was a several hours long ordeal, and surely not the way my mother had intended to spend her Friday night at the end of a long week. A few years later, another white girlfriend, one with whom I exchanged notes and enjoyed a friendly classroom competition for grades, came up to me and asked, "Can I touch your hair?" Today, I would give her every side eye I have and affirm no. But back then, I let her touch it. Her reply, "It's so soft. I thought it would feel more like a Brillo pad." Her daddy, she once whispered to me, didn't much care for black people either. These, though, were my friends. And this was the deep stew of Southern 1990s adolescence that shaped my own conception of girlhood. Effectively shunned by most of the other black girls who didn't yet have the tools to understand their black girl magic or to make space for mine, I would have had no friends but for these white girls who invited me to sleepovers, pool parties, and the movies. But so much of what it meant to be a black girl among white girls was to be a spectator and co-conspirator in their construction of me as the other, as not quite like them. By escaping into the world of my beloved babysitter friends and later into the world of Elizabeth and Jessica, the Sweet Valley twins, I could be a spectator and an imagined participant without risk. In this fictive world, I imagined race was only incidental, and I got to revel in the shared tween and teen shenanigans of other girls unencumbered by social difference. To be clear, I did not fully consent to my own othering. I read every black book my aunt sent, played with the paper dolls of Josephine Baker that arrived in one of the books, and diligently hunted for every book in Mildred Taylor's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry trilogy. On Saturday mornings, we cleaned the house while Video Soul and Soul Train played on the TV, and on lazy Saturday evenings, Luther Vandross, Johnny Gill, and Alexander O'Neill blasted from my mother's stereo system. In sixth grade, my mama thought it would be fun to take me to my first concert. It featured MC Light for me, Mickey Howard for her, David Peaston, and Surface. The hip-hop of the 90s, which I loved, had its fair share of strong female leads, dope sisters who were kicking butt and taking names. These women were unbowed by the male-centered nature of hip-hop culture. Hip-hop is all about loud, rowdy, and raunchy testosterone-driven narratives. These women thrived both because of and in spite of the culture. If you ask me the most memorable figures in the soundtrack to my girlhood and adolescence, my personal hip-hop mixtape would be primarily female. My first favorite hip-hop group was JJ Fad, a bubblegum pop girl group whose 1988 hit Supersonic had an infectious beat that I still remember hearing for the first time as a 7-year-old in the passenger seat of my big cousin's blue Pontiac Sunbird on a country summer excursion to the corner store. JJ Fad was gimmicky, but when I heard them for the first time, I paid attention to girls who rhymed. For the concert, my mother, who always took more interest in my appearance, thankfully, than I did, had hustled me over to Cato Fashions for an outfit. Once I reached tween age, every school year my mother would go to Cato and put a few outfits on layaway for me, so I could look fresh at the start of school. But this was a special treat. I remember that I had a cute top and these awesome baggy purple pants that felt cool and cute, and kind of like hip-hop. I was ready when MC Light came out and lit up the stage. A pioneering MC in hip-hop, Light is the exemplar of a strong female lead. She is, to this day, a confident lyricist who tells it like it is, while coming off as supremely unbothered by any haters who would dare to step to her. Between Light, Queen Latifah, Da Brat, and later Lauryn Hill, Missy Elliott, Lil' Kim, and Foxy Brown, I was blessed to come of age in the era of the female MC. Despite my lack of black girlfriends, listening to black music, hip-hop and R&B made me know that I was a real black girl even if none of the other black girls around me saw it. Like Ashley Banks, the little sister on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, I had a massive crush on Tevin Campbell and squealed when my mama surprised me with a cassette tape of his debut album, Tevin. Black girls frequently tease me for talking white and acting white, but I still remember the exhilaration of seeing MC Light command a stage for the first time, watching Queen Latifah check sexist dudes in the UNITY video, and learning all the words to Da Brat's Funkified. Most of my love of black girl pop icons and black music lived out of sight of anyone but my mother. That tucking away of my black girlness, even as I simultaneously tucked away my awareness of my friend's whiteness, was a survival skill that I honed in part by reading and immersing myself in the stories of white girls' lives. Before we fully learn to love ourselves, all people of color in the United States learn that we are supporting characters and spectators in the collective story of white people's lives. The stories we watch and read ask us to put aside their whiteness and relate to their very universal human struggles around conflict with the world, the self, and others. The problem is that only the experiences of white people are treated as universal. Meanwhile, black movies, shows, and books are typically seen as limited and particular. By escaping regularly into the saccharine world of fictional white girlhood, I could find respite from grappling with the enormously complicated and devastating meanings of Rodney King, Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, and the LA riots, even as all of these formative narratives about the precarity of blackness and black womanhood were happening around me. And this brings me back to the moment that I, along with the rest of America, got our first taste of Bill and Hillary Clinton. When the Arkansas governor burst onto the political stage in 1992, it seemed pretty clear that there was something unique about him. His charm was then as now, legendary. When I wasn't in the fictive world of Stony Brook, Connecticut, or the raucous world of early 90s hip-hop, I was devouring teen magazines. Those magazines had begun to cover a political couple from Arkansas that they referred to as Billary. Before there were corny celebrity portmanteaus like Bennifer and Brangelina, there was Billary. But Billary was not in the least celebratory. It was a derisive dig at Hillary Clinton's political ambitions and her attempt to move away from the traditional first lady role of being a decorous appendage to the president. I wasn't that interested in politics, but I found the wordplay clever. I watched as Hillary Clinton built a name for herself, mostly by ignoring her charismatic husband's notoriously womanizing ways. As the news of Bill Clinton's affair with Jennifer Flowers made headlines, I learned that men don't lose presidencies over cheating on their wives. Moreover, Hillary Clinton was an ambitious wife who made a failed bid for an office in the West Wing during her husband's first term. Americans admired her loyalty to her husband almost as much as they despised her political ambitions. I also learned that if wives have the nerve to have ambitions beyond wifehood, the public chastening and disciplining is even more severe. So much of Hillary Clinton's career in the public eye reads like a modern version of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. Oddly enough, two of my favorite movies, both of which emerged just as Hillary Clinton ran for and won her Senate seat in New York, are remakes of Shrew. And I love both the white version, 10 Things I Hate About You, 1999, and the black version, Deliver Us from Eva, 2003. I love them because I always identified with the strong female leads at the center of these stories. Hillary Clinton's personal and professional life has been shaped by the consequences she has faced for being an ambitious and untamed woman. Though I believe she and Bill enjoy a great friendship and a political partnership, his multiple infidelities and his flaunting of them in public have certainly had the effect, if not the intent, of disciplining his wife into the role of supportive, loyal spouse. And for playing that role with aplomb, Hillary Clinton garnered the respect of many women across race and class lines. My mother told me after the Monica Lewinsky scandal, "I like Hillary. She's handling this in such a classy way." By that November, as the Clintons were on their way to the White House and a historic number of women on their way to Congress, the press had declared 1992 the year of the woman. Still, when Hillary made her failed bid for the West Wing office so she could push the agenda of universal health care coverage, she was roundly lambasted, publicly hated, and again culturally disciplined into silence. But she put the world on notice that, as Beyonce might say, "I'm not just his little wife." I have always lingered over stories of women who lead, women who know what they want out of this world, and women who demand that others respect them and recognize their magic. When Hillary decided to run for president in 2008, I had initially planned to vote for her. Before my admiration for Michelle and Barack Obama, and frankly my racial loyalty, caused me to ascend the hope train, I could think of no more qualified person to be our first female president. When again she chose to run in 2016, my fervor for her was renewed. This was despite the fact that she had called 13-year-old black children super predators in support of her husband's 1994 crime bill. I was 13 when she said it, just like her daughter. And despite the fact that in 2008 she seemed to entertain the notion that someone shooting Barack Obama would put her in line for the nomination, and despite the fact that her husband made a bunch of entitled and thinly veiled racist statements to the people of South Carolina when they backed Barack Obama in 2008. My relationship with white girls is and remains complicated, and in the public parts of my life, for good or ill, white women's racism has never kept me from admiring them, befriending them, or supporting them. This has been true for multiple generations of black women, especially in the South. I understand Hillary Clinton at the nexus of these competing narratives of my own womanhood and girlhood, my complicated relationship with white women, my innate admiration for strong women, and my hard-won understanding of the similarities between how black and white communities constrict and resent women who seek power. The latter lesson I learned during my junior year at Howard University, when I decided to run for student body president. Coincidentally, that was the same year that Hillary Clinton took office as a U.S. senator. I felt that, as an overachiever my whole life and an enthusiastic joiner ever since Mandy told me about Girl Scouts in the second grade, running the student body was a natural progression of my many years leading and serving in student organizations in high school and college, debate team, Young Lawyers Association, and future business leaders. I took this joiner sensibility right into college, where I eagerly embraced all kinds of student associations, honors clubs, and various positions in the expansive student government network that comprises Howard University. In my junior year, I decided that I was ready for the big time, president of the Howard University Student Association. Together with my running mate, Mark, I threw my hat in the ring. At Howard, the only historically black college located in the nation's capital, student government campaigns are simulations of real life. Candidates spend in the thousands of dollars for fancy campaign logos and posters and splashy events to attract attention. Naive and idealistic, I had yet to learn at age 20 that elections are as much about popularity as about policy. In the cheerleader jock nerd nexus of my high school, I understood and steered clear of this. I was the girl who worked out much of what I experienced in the real world by escaping into the world of books and ideas. At Howard, no one knew the student handbook, the intercollege student government structure, or the minutiae of policies and procedures better than I did. Knowing all of these policies and procedures would equip me, I thought, to lead people. On the day that my running mate and I went to meet with the university president, I laid out my ambitious agenda. President Swigert looked at me as if amused and said, "You have to get elected first." I was taken aback. I didn't fully understand the comment. It felt dismissive, condescending, and insulting. Didn't he know who I was? I had never at that point failed at any major endeavor in my life, and I didn't plan to fail at this one. Still, although it was before the age of Facebook, he had scribbled the proverbial writing on my wall. As the election season progressed, my polling teams, yes, polling teams, would go out across the campus and canvass dorms on my behalf. They always began with two questions. Who do you think has the best command of the issues, and who do you plan to vote for? Invariably, the response to question one would be Brittany and Mark. The response to question two would be Stephanie and Alex, our erstwhile opponents who would eventually emerge victorious. Completely nonplussed by this information, I was even more taken aback by the other kinds of feedback my teens brought back with them. Students said I needed to be more feminine. I should wear stud earrings rather than my signature hoops. To this day, I only occasionally deviate from hoops. I needed to style my permed hair more effectively and wear suits and heels. I was awkward, overweight, and far more interested in books and politics than in makeup and hairstyles. I didn't even really know where to begin. Wholly naive to the world of political campaigns, I could not understand people who thought I knew the issues better than anyone but planned to vote for someone else. But that is what they did. Stephanie and Alex won in a landslide against us and another ticket. I should have known how it would go on election day when a known campus busybody sent a passive-aggressive message to me through one of my friends that my jeans, campaign t-shirt, and sneakers didn't look presidential. My spirit crushed and my eyes opened to the intimate cruelty of politics. I was not a gracious loser. I did not call to congratulate the winners. I skipped class the next day, ashamed to show my failure of a face on campus, opting instead to sulk in the darkness of the movies. And I spent much of my senior year disillusioned with a campus that I felt had betrayed me despite several years of committed service. But many of the failures were mine. Mind you, it never even occurred to me to canvass dorms with my team. The thought of soliciting strangers for votes still gives me anxiety. Clearly, I shouldn't have been running. It was dramatic and devastating in the way that first failures for overachievers tend to be. It was a painful opportunity to see myself through the mirror of others and find my reflection wanting. Over the course of my 20s, it became a lesson in figuring out what things about myself I would retain and what things I wanted to change. I learned first and foremost, though, that if people can't trust you, you can't lead them. Second, I learned that electoral politics weren't the thing for me. Perhaps that's petty, but living a life being evaluated by other people's impressions of me felt like too much. The third thing I learned is that it wasn't just about qualifications or competence or commitment, but about helping people feel connected. As a bit of an introvert and not much of a people person, I had failed to make the connection. Stephanie, my opponent, did. Students could relate to her. They found her to be genuine rather than haughty or uptight. I was used to being one of the smartest people in the room, and I acted like it, primarily as a defense mechanism. I didn't see Hillary Clinton's loss in the 2016 election coming. Like most Americans and most of the polling numbers, I assumed that we had arrived at a place where America was ready for a female president, especially one as hyper-competent as Clinton. In the late hours of November 8th, 2016, when it became clear that she would lose, I was nothing short of heartbroken. Perhaps I should have been less optimistic. The writing was on the wall. For more than 20 years, journalists have written essays about the reasons people hate Hillary Clinton. Every time I heard or read one of those pieces, I winced, remembering acutely how it felt to be deemed overqualified but simultaneously disliked and distrusted. The things that made others distrust Hillary Clinton were the things that made me like her. Something about her social awkwardness, her detail-oriented policy-wonk tendencies, and her devotion to the long game of racking up qualifications through intentional resume building feels familiar, because it is the very same strategy of every high-achieving black woman I know. Often black women are cast as cold and unfeeling for having these qualities. But the hustling spirit that I saw in Hillary Clinton resonated with the oft-repeated black proverb, you have to work twice as hard to get half as far. Black women and girls are forced to navigate the unreasonably high expectations that go along with proverbs like this throughout their lives. I'll come back to that later. But I believe that there is no other group of women who can understand just how devastating Hillary Clinton's loss was than black women. What might feel like a singular and stunning defeat for her is one that black women learn to live with every day. The sense that you are a woman before your time, that your brilliance and talents are limited by the historical moment and the retrograde politics within that moment in which you find yourself living. Black women from slavery to freedom know that struggle so much more than any white person ever will. Hillary appealed to the parts of me that care far less about impressing people than about figuring out the nuts and bolts of the kind of thinking that will actually help people. She appealed to the parts of me that despise the insincerity and superficiality of small talk. She appealed to the parts of me that come alive in intimate settings when I have the chance to connect with real people. My ability to empathize with a woman whose life and political commitments diverge significantly from my own is rooted in the ways I learned in early childhood to understand and negotiate the complex humanity of white women even before I learned to negotiate my own. I learned to like and value certain white women despite their racism long before I learned how to prioritize and value my own black girl magic. So yes, I think patriarchy had something to do with Hillary, whom Barack Obama called the most qualified person ever to run for the job, losing the election to a man who probably struggles to spell the word competent. The fact that 53% of white women voted against her bears all the marks of the internecine ways that patriarchy pits women in an endless competition with one another. Throughout the election season, I witnessed so many white women on both the right and the left rolling their eyes and saying, ooh and every time Hillary Clinton came up in conversation. Somewhere in the midst of the time I spent being friends with white girls, I missed their penchant for doing mean girl shit to each other. Everything about the ways that white women endlessly analyzed and picked Hillary apart felt like it came from the mean girl playbook that we all learn in middle school. Perhaps it's sexist of me to reduce legitimate political analyses down to mean girl infighting, but the political distrust and disdain for Hillary Clinton is as outsized as the vitriol that some black feminists reserve for Beyonce. Look, it's not just black and white women who I think keep replaying middle school angst. Working class white men's over-identification with Donald Trump, a man who clearly despises them, is the stuff of middle school fantasy too. Perhaps it is difficult to hear that electoral contests still are what they've always been, popularity contests. And popularity is dictated by all of the worst forms of social privilege. We're conditioned to like the people who are pretty, charming, handsome, rich, and well-connected. Donald Trump sure ain't pretty, but he is rich and well-connected, and that means that lots of white men who will never be either of these things secretly identify with him. That's all I'm saying. That so many of the emotional impulses that shape our engagements with powerful public figures have to do with the shit we went through in middle school. I really wish people would just go to therapy. The young and woke ones on the black left also refuse to give too much credence to patriarchy's influence on the election. Many of these black folks, some of them new and first-time voters and some of them old-school contrarians, saw Hillary Clinton as a shill for the neoliberal establishment Democrats, a racist doing her husband's bidding, a woman unworthy of being a poster child for feminist anything. It seemed reasonable to them to protest every imperial fault of the American Republic on Hillary Clinton's back. Meanwhile, these same folks lined up behind Bernie Sanders, a socialist who had radical things to say about money, but not much else. I never believed the Bernie hype. Perhaps it's problematic identity politics, but I left white savior narratives alone a long time ago. Bernie's Johnny-come-lately race analysis, which he hastily put together after young black women bum-rushed him on stage at a rally, felt as opportunistic to me as Hillary's belated engagement with the politics of race. It didn't matter to me that Bernie had participated in the civil rights movement, and frankly, his close proximity to that degree of racial animus made his absence of racial analysis more than 50 years later even more egregious. Moreover, I found it especially terrible that when it came to racial politics, many young progressives across racial lines were far more willing to train their hatred on Hillary Clinton, a white woman, than on Bernie Sanders, a white man. White women have absolutely been accomplices to the American project of white supremacy, but their husbands, brothers, fathers, and sons have always been the masterminds. Let us never forget that. Having grown up in a world where white women were frequently a mixed bag, I couldn't technically disagree with assessments of Clinton as a racist and a neoliberal big money politician. My problem was that every politician on the left since Bill Clinton has been exactly this kind of politician. I didn't understand how people, knowing how patriarchy works, expected the first woman president in a deeply masculinist and patriarchal democracy to break the mold. People demanded nothing short of political purity from a woman fighting for a position in a system that has been stained bright red with the blood of countless marginalized groups from the beginning. Women are to be pure and unsullied, maternal and nurturing, and the conscience of the republic. Clinton was maternal to her one child only and not much interested in any of those other qualities. And many Americans, including the young of all races who have grown up with patriarchal expectations as barely detectable background noise, hated Clinton for all the ways in which she did not conform to these dictates. At the same time, a curious thing was happening among young black feminists and progressives who hated Hillary Clinton because she was entirely too white. These folks focused on her race and class politics exhaustively and treated her gender and her long life as a woman in politics as though it were incidental rather than central to the narrative. Even before I embraced feminism, the Howard campus election taught me that patriarchy is always on its job. Other things like race, class, and sexual orientation might be central, but gender always matters. The angst I felt over being deemed simultaneously too good and not good enough set me on the path to feminism. For the first time on a campus that was committed to all black everything, I ran headlong into the politics of gender. Yes, my opponent, a woman, won. But in addition to her clear talent for politics and her doing an admittedly really great job as student body president, she also met respectable standards of femininity that I hadn't even truly been aware existed. On the day of the campus election, she wore a dark-colored suit and heels. I had no knowledge of the social mores of looking presidential. Never before had my clothing and appearance been policed in this way, other than by my mother. My insistence on a uniform of jeans and tennis shoes was, I'm sure, a subconscious rebellion against this very same mother who, to this day, owns neither a pair of jeans nor a pair of sneakers. Never before had I encountered a world where the merit of my ideas didn't rule the day. Even in high school, though top grades and impressive college admissions didn't protect me from racism, the racists did not win. Never before had I been made to care so much about how my existence and manner of moving through the world made other people feel. I wrote my first ever op-ed about my experience for the campus newspaper. Before Rebecca Solnit gifted us the term mansplaining, several brothers approached me on campus having read my article, wanting to know how the demand that I wear lipstick and smaller earrings was any different from the unspoken edict that they shave their cornrows or locks. True enough, Howard, like many other black colleges, had and has a culture of respectability when it comes to what constitutes professional attire. The politics of respectability is predicated on extremely conservative ideas about what a proper race man and a proper race woman are and should look like. I watched over the course of 4 years as many young men in the School of Business cut their dreadlocks just in time for senior year and the waiting job market. Still, I offered every brother that stepped to me a withering glare and asked, "Do you really think this is the same thing?" The stakes weren't the same. Respectability politics rooted in sexist ideas suggested that I wasn't qualified to be president because I wasn't feminine enough and was not enough of a lady. Because my male colleagues were straight men, their masculinity was not called into question. No one had said that they weren't masculine enough to be president. I didn't have the language for that then. My lack of answers to these questions left me with a sinking feeling in my gut that even though I was more than halfway through college, I didn't have even half of the answers I needed about my life as a black woman. I wasn't a feminist yet, but my unquestioned commitment to a race-only politic was like sand slowly slipping through the fingers of my tightly clenched black power fist. I also never questioned my femininity because even though I've never been hyper-feminine, I'm most at home in the company of other women. Ever since the days of Girl Scouts and the Babysitter's Club, I have been a girl's girl. My understanding of my girlhood and my womanhood has always been forged in relationship to other women and girls, black and white. At Howard, I ran squarely up against the intersection of race and gender, racism and sexism in ways that I could not foresee. The kind of black womanhood that Howard valued in its leaders during my time there in the early 2000s was a womanhood different from my own, opinionated, outspoken, and far too serious. I didn't temper my mouth with cute hairstyles or clothes. I didn't know I needed to. White women taught me about racism. Black institutions like Howard and the Black Church gave me a primer on sexism. My relationship to both are consequently complicated. Of course, white women weren't my only examples of strong female leads. My life had been intimately shaped by strong women leading. In the intimate world that shaped me, black women, my grandmother, my mother, and my three aunts ran everything. They cooked the meals, worked the jobs, paid the bills, managed the kids, extinguished fires, told off racist teachers, and put out bad lovers, parted, greased, and plaited hair every night and every morning, sewed, washed, and ironed clothes, taught us to pray, picked a mean switch for a good whooping, and drew the boundaries of every black child's world with a simple look. But the world of girls and women outside of my home was white. In graduate school, I read the Combahee River Collective, a group of black feminist activists from the 1970s who gave me a new understanding of identity politics, a term they invented. I had learned early how to disidentify with whiteness, but never fully how to inhabit, embrace, and identify with my particular black girl magic. They argued in their famous black feminist statement written in 1977 that, quote, our politics evolve from a healthy love for ourselves, our sisters, and our community, which allows us to continue our struggle and work. So they adopted what they called identity politics, a belief that, quote, the most profound and potentially radical politics come directly out of our own identity. These politics of identity were radically different from the disidentity politics that shaped my youth. These were black women speaking a language of liberation, of self-possession, that I didn't even know I needed. I like strong female leads, black and white alike. I want to be strong. Badass women have to be strong. But I don't ever want to be strong in ways that are inauthentic, dishonest, and dangerous to my health and well-being. Black feminism taught me that in the battle with white women over racism and with black men over sexism, I can never go wrong in picking myself. But I'm grown, and I know the choices are never so black and white. I love, embrace, and keep company with black men who have yet to fully or even remotely reckon with their sexism because those black men are my father figures, brothers, cousins, friends, and lovers. Similarly, I can, in limited instances, admire and offer support to white women who have not yet fully reckoned with their racism. I can also admit that the struggle to take down the patriarchy will be a very limited endeavor if white women aren't a part of it. I do wish white feminists would embrace the notion, however, that in this new feminist movement we are all trying to build, they aren't automatically our choice for strong female lead. The smartest man I never knew. Every time I hear calls from young radical activists to burn it all down and start again, I feel more fear and distress than possibility. While there are a fair number of black women across history who have believed in revolutionary violence, the posture of burning shit down feels decidedly masculinist to me. Our nation's story is one of men using violence against Native folks, against black folks, and against women to build and fund a grand experiment in democracy. Very often, when we think about the way the United States likes to wield its big stick abroad through military might, we forget that this project is inherently phallic. Picking on countries full of people of color with less money and resources is also a racist and imperial project. Lots of young activists of color that I know point to this. They point to the way police occupy black communities like our military forces occupy places abroad. But militarism isn't just racist. It's also patriarchal, sexist, and masculinist. Far too many black men crib from this same playbook, believing setting fire to white men's institutions while laying claim to land and women is what freedom looks like. My mother's father was a military man, a World War II vet. For many black men, joining the military was their only viable option to make something of themselves in a world where they couldn't finish school and couldn't go on to college. The men in my family lived down south, the place from which other black people fled during the Great Migration. There were no good factory jobs in these rural small towns near the Mississippi Delta to create economic opportunity for those who didn't go north. The military provided a salary and a pension. It also provided an avenue for black men to become the kind of normative, proud, self-supporting men that are valorized in a patriarchy. In my grandfather's case, his time in the military also gave him bragging rights. According to the big white leather family Bible that sat on the coffee table next to my grandmother's weekly subscription to Jet magazine, Grandfather Henry saw action at Normandy. He came back from the war with an injury that he lived with until his death 25 years later. At some point after he returned from the war, he married my grandmother, a young woman 16 years his junior. Depending on who tells the story, my grandfather's personality has many faces. My mother's older sisters remember him as a mischievous and fun-loving father who piled them all into the pickup truck and took them down to the juke joint, leaving them to play in the truck for hours while he went in and gambled with his friends. My grandmother told me stories of the fights they'd have, most likely after he came back drunk from the juke. "Yes, I fought him," she'd say, reveling in her ability to stand toe-to-toe with her man. But she also spoke of the PTSD he carried. Cooper, which is what she called him, could not sleep on white sheets. My God, he would carry on if I ever tried to make him sleep on white sheets. One can only imagine the horrors those white sheets conjured for a World War II vet born in 1911. My mother, the baby of the family, remembered her father in his old age as a gentle giant with huge hands that she'd hold as they walked around the yard to help him get his exercise. It's not too far a leap to think that her love for her own father, a volatile but loving family man, shaped the kinds of men my mother came to love when she was grown enough, or thought she was. Bob was also a military man, several years older, tall, dark, handsome, charming, and gentle. Just the kind of man that makes mothers scared for their daughters. My grandmother warned my mother away, telling her that Bob was no good for her. As is the custom of daughters, my mother thought my grandmother didn't know what she was talking about. So Mama let Bob shoot his shot. She obliged him and things went along like a dream until, as she mentioned later, in that way that black women can say everything while saying so little, he didn't treat me right. As a younger woman, I wanted to know what that meant. As a grown woman who's lived a little bit of life, the broad outlines feel clear. The details matter less. My mother, a pretty, charming, smart, and ambitious girl in her first year of college, left Bob and pursued her bliss. At 18, her bliss was another older man, himself home from a stint in the military. Charming and smart, man swiftly took up the space Bob had left. Bob, a Vietnam vet who would later tell my mother that his head was all screwed up from the war, viewed it as a betrayal of the sort that deserved retribution. On a Saturday afternoon in March, Bob came upon my mother and man sitting in a car across the street from Big Mama's, man's mother's house. A young woman from the neighborhood would later tell my mother that she saw Bob coming and ran toward the car, waving her arms wildly in the rearview mirror, trying to get my mother's attention. Man somehow saw Bob coming and gestured for his 9-year-old nephew David to go into the house. David heard a pop, pop, pop as soon as he made it inside the door. Outside, Bob shot my mother 3 times and man once. My mother awoke in the hospital to her older sister, Linda, asking her if she knew where she was and whether she understood what had happened. Mama had blocked out the shooting, but she knew enough to tell her sister, "Bob shot me." In the manner of rural Southern boys, my mother's big brother had ridden around all night with a shotgun and a willingness to kill. Bob called, wanting to know if my mother was alive. Lil Mama, my mother's grandmother, simply said to my mother as she lay in the hospital bed fighting for her life, "Baby, you didn't do nothing wrong." It has been nearly 38 years since a grown man, drunk on his own sense of entitlement, attempted to murder my mother. According to several years of reports by the Violence Policy Center, in this, the second decade of the 21st century, 8 black women per week, more than 1 per day, are murdered, usually with guns, and usually by a black male they know. More than 1,000 women of all races are murdered every year, in similar incidents, usually by men of their own race. It has been said before, but it is worth saying again. Toxic masculinity kills. At 18 years old and in good health, my mother thankfully recovered. A few weeks later, she found out that she was pregnant with man's baby, with me. The first time she heard my heartbeat big and strong, she felt like she was floating on air, renewed in her decision to bring her pregnancy to term. All 3 of us, my mother, my father, and me, had survived the shooting. Put another way, we had survived a black man attempting to murder us. Because my mother now had a baby to support, she did not return to college for her sophomore year. She recovered from the shooting, gave birth to me in late 1980, and started her career at a local company at the beginning of 1981. My father struggled, using alcohol to medicate his pain and trauma in the same way that his father, my grandfather, Claudie, also known as Big Daddy, had done. On weekends, man got drunk and came home to fight my mother. Many years after his passing, his sister, my Aunt Maddie, told me, "He loved your mother. That was the only way he knew to show it. That was all he'd ever seen. Inadvertently, she had revealed something of the dynamics between Big Mama and Big Daddy, dynamics that I had been oblivious to as a child because I knew Big Daddy only as the lovable town drunk. I saw him far more frequently posted up under a tree in the projects with a brown paper bag in his pocket than I ever saw him at Big Mama's house. I call it her house because I never remember seeing him there. And whenever I ran into him, Big Daddy always gave me the biggest smile, happy to see me. Many of my friends and I, with grandparents who grew up in the aftermath of World War II, repeat to each other the stories our parents handed down to us in hushed voices of how their parents got drunk and caroused all weekend and then came home and took their anxieties, fears, and frustrations out on each other. The women sometimes got brutally beaten or killed, but sometimes they gave as good as they got. This had been the script of both my grandfathers, Henry and Claudie. It was the script my mother had to work with when she chose whom to love. It was the script of both the men she loved as a young woman. Of my father, my mother has said, "Your dad and I would work all week trying to build something, and then in one weekend, he could go out and destroy everything we had worked that week to build." This is the father I remember, the weekend bringer of chaos and destruction, not the faithful, sober builder who showed up Monday through Friday, not the man who my mother made ride shotgun with her to drop me off each morning at daycare because I cried too much when she left me. Men aren't born destroyers. Many men imbibe scripts of toxic masculinity almost from birth, and on their way to becoming men, they enact those toxic scripts in the lives of the women around them. It's important to remember that this conclusion is not inevitable, but that's the thing that will drive you mad when you lose someone tragically, wondering about the inevitability of the outcome. It was a Saturday morning on the 14th of April at around 5 a.m. when the phone rang in our house. It was exactly 10 years and 2 weeks after Bob had shot my parents. I heard my mama on the phone saying, "How am I going to tell this girl?" I knew something bad had happened, but didn't know what or to whom. Ever the straight shooter, my mama asked me to get up, and when we sat down in the living room, she said simply, "Somebody shot and killed your dad last night." I was in the fourth grade, and by that time I was well acquainted with my daddy being shot. He had been shot when I was in the second grade and again when I was in the third grade. Both of those times in the time with Bob, he had survived. This time, he had not. I sat on the sofa, digging my toes into our bright blue carpet, shaking my head, trying to make sense of the senseless. "We should get over to Big Mama's house. She's not doing too well," my mama said. We got dressed hurriedly, climbed in the car, and drove the couple of miles down the road to Big Mama's house. Inside, Big Mama's face was racked with grief, and she kind of rocked from side to side. Aunt Lil, my daddy's baby sister, was distraught. "Man never liked Friday the 13th. He never did," she was saying to no one in particular. But apparently my daddy had violated one of his own edicts by being out of the house on that Friday night. Over the weeks and years to come, a few more bits and pieces of the story would trickle in. My daddy had been at his girlfriend's house. A man, perhaps the landlord, perhaps a former lover, came by angry about money, waving a gun around, threatening her and her children. My daddy intervened and ended up dead, shot in the head. For the second time, my daddy had become the victim of another man's vendetta against the special woman in his life. Each and every time men try to deflect conversations about intimate partner violence in black communities by talking about how men are victims of abuse too, I want to hit them myself. Patriarchy and toxic masculinity, together with alcoholism and militarism, turned my father into a violent man. But patriarchy also killed him. In the 9 shared years of our story together, years framed entirely by the gratuitous violence of men, I struggled to know this man, my father, this mischievous brother called man by his family, who was a bit superstitious, a bit of a romantic, a wild dancer, and a man willing to take a bullet more than once for a woman he loved. The father I knew harassed and terrorized my mother and me. He regularly upended and disrupted our lives, demanding much but giving little. The man I knew as my dad did not square in any way with the man who was beloved by his family. In the 8th grade, my substitute teacher, Mr. Roebuck, happened to be a good friend of my mother's and a minor local celebrity who DJed at the local radio station. Soul Row was his DJ name. In that way that Southern Black people have with each other, I went up to him after class and said, "I think you know my mother." And like Black Southerners are wont to do, Mr. Roebuck scaffolded me into a whole local genealogy, assessing rather quickly who my people were. "I knew your daddy, too," he told me. I had no idea what he might say next because I couldn't imagine what good thing he might have to say about my daddy. "He was a really smart guy," Mr. Roebuck told me, to my great surprise. "I saw him walking down the street one day and gave him a ride. He talked to me about starving children in Africa and all kinds of things, not the kind of things you would think a cat walking along the side of the road would be thinking about. I had heard my father's sister's stories about how he was smart as a whip, about how he did Lil's homework, about how he never had to study for tests. I've never met a test I didn't have to study for. But other people outside the family thought my dad, the same man who had come late one night and slashed all the tires on my mother's car, was smart. Like, really smart. To the point that it was worth remarking on. Mr. Roebuck was subbing in my gifted and talented class, and for the first time, he introduced me to the idea that my daddy might have bequeathed to me more than grief, that my father, and not just my mother, might have had something to do with the precocity and intelligence that everyone in my family bragged on me for having. Several months after my conversation with Mr. Roebuck, I tumbled back into grief, unable, as I had been able to do at age 9, to tuck in the fear of violence and death that were the natural aftermath of losing a parent. I could not reconcile the thoughtful, empathetic man that Mr. Roebuck had picked up along the side of the road with the man who used to ring our old green rotary phone incessantly, making it impossible to spend an evening at home in peace. The man Sol Roe knew, who had empathy and concern for everybody else's children, Africa's children, his girlfriend's children, didn't seem to have any empathy or tangible concern for his own daughter. My father wanted me to know him. Well acquainted with his violence, I felt I knew him as much as I would ever need to know him. After an evening of drunken reveling, it was customary for him to call and demand that my mother put Brittany on the phone. "She doesn't want to talk to you, man," my mother would say while I shook my head. Listening from the other end, I'd hear, "No, I haven't turned her against you." And after he refused to hang up, "Here," Mama would say, handing me the phone, "talk to your daddy." "Why don't you want to talk to me?" he'd ask, hoping I would provide some evidence of my mother's campaign to turn me against him. There had been no such campaigns. "Because you hurt my mama," I'd say. "Do you love me?" Daddy asked me once. "No, because you hurt Mama." I didn't even think twice about telling my daddy I didn't love him. How could I love him? I'd seen him inflict pain with my own two eyes. Small and powerless, I'd heard him slamming my mother into doors, even while I screamed and cried from the other room for him to stop. "Well, I love you," he said, sounding quite sober. Then he demanded that my mother drop me off to spend the day with him so that I would know him. That day he gave me as much peanut butter and jelly mixed together in a green bowl as I wanted to eat. When my mother came to pick me up, he didn't fight her, but other times he did. Seeing me was frequently a pretext for seeing her. But people are never the sum total of the wrongs that they do. Men aren't born monsters. The only time I ever thought I loved my dad was when I went to see him one of the times after he'd been shot. He was walking around with a cane, sober and genuinely happy to see me. He smiled and I smiled back, these smiles and faces mere images of each other. On the ride back home, I told Mama, "Maybe I love my daddy." She said nothing. Her position on my dad was always that everything regarding him was better left unsaid. She left me to form my own opinions. I don't remember whether it was the second grade shooting or the third grade shooting. That's how I marked the time. When he got shot, as my mother told me, in the lower stomach. Years later, my Aunt Maddie clarified that one of his testicles had been shot off, but she told me my dad had attended the court date for the shooter. During his remarks to the judge, Daddy said, "Don't lock him up. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy." There was that radical empathy again, that fairly sophisticated sense that locking up a man for a drunken street fight that had gotten out of control didn't in fact constitute justice. Losing a testicle, my dad had suffered a violent and material blow to his own masculinity, but still he didn't equate carceral solutions with justice. At 13, 4 years after the gun finally won and Mr. Roebuck disrupted, my particular memories of my father as mostly a monster. These competing narratives bubbled over, haunting me each night. My mother made a way, despite limited income, to put me in therapy. Twice a week, the summer after eighth grade, I would go to sit on the sofa with Dr. Rick, a middle-aged white man with glasses, a beard, and a long chin. At some point, Dr. Rick assessed that the cause of my anger, the thing keeping me up nights and making me anxious, was that I needed to know my father better. The few good memories of my father that I have, the time he walked me to the store and bought me bubble yum, or the time he sat me on his shoulders and took me for a walk while he whistled a tune, had been overshadowed by all the negative memories. Dr. Rick sent me on a fact-finding mission to gather pictures of my dad, which I didn't have, and to figure out some of my dad's story. Talking to family friends, I started to put the pieces together, trying to connect the version of the story that I had to the version of the story that others told. Aunt Maddie, my dad's oldest sister and the keeper of the family history, happily welcomed me for a visit armed with old pictures, letters, and stories. In a letter dated 24 March 75, my dad wrote to her from his post in Germany. "This is a beautiful place over here. I've seen towns sitting on top of mountains and towns sitting way down.